This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Best bits from Tuesday, March the 26th. Coming up, some big stories emanating from the United States. All the latest on the Boeing saga as yet another chapter is written there. Overnight, we've had news coming through of the resignation, or the stepping down, as they're putting it, of both the chairman, the CEO, and also the chief commercial officer. What does that say about the Boeing story as a whole? Donald Trump, Boeing had a bad day yesterday. Donald Trump had a good day yesterday. A big focus on Donald Trump's day in court. He saw his bail order reduced significantly. Also saw his personal wealth increase significantly as well. Plus, big focus on all things energy, big focus on all things oil as well, as we keep an eye on the fluctuating oil price. Talking of energy, looking at alternative sources of energy, that's certainly what the UAE has been doing with the development of the Al Baraka nuclear plant. The Nuclear Safety Director of the Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation. That's the body that has been established to oversee nuclear development here for energy purposes, is Sara Al-Sadi. She was kind enough to join us live in Studio Y. Now the Al Baraka plant is completely operational. So we got all the latest from Sara. We spoke also to the Chief Academic Officer of HCT. They're the Higher Colleges of Technology. Significant percentage of the Emirati workforce in recent years have come through Higher Colleges of Technology. But they are looking ahead to the future. They are looking to future-proof that workplace, the evolving workplace at the moment, by developing a number of new initiatives to promote hands-on or applied learning for their students moving into the workforce. We were joined live by Dr. Luc Verburg, who joined us to tell us a bit more about this new initiative from HCT. And also joining us live in studio was the commercial director of the Arena Group, Minnie Wallington, was live in studio. Why? It is, of course, Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan. Traditionally, you see a number of Ramadan tents popping up, around the city. We are not seeing that this year. Is that to do with the weather? Is that to do with the economy? Questions we put to Minnie a little earlier on. That's all right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast.
Busy day over in the United States. Two big stories. We will get to Donald Trump. What a day for him in a few moments' time. But first of all, Dave Calhoun stepping down as CEO of Boeing. He's going to leave at the end of the year. Other big departures at Boeing as well. Dave Calhoun fronted up after the announcement. He spoke to the guys at CNBC in an extended interview. One of the things they asked him was, did you fall or were you pushed? Was this your decision, Dave?
Yeah, first of all, 100%. Why now? I've entered my fifth year. At the end of this year, I'll be close to 68 years old. I've always said to the board, and the board has been very prepared, I would give them plenty of notice so that they could understand and plan succession in regular order. And that's what this is about. It's me giving them notice that at the end of this year, I plan to retire. We have another mountain to climb. Let's not avoid what happened with Alaska Air. Let's not avoid the call for action. Let's not avoid the changes that we have to make in our factory. Let's not avoid the need to slow down a bit and let the supply chain catch up. We got to get at that, just like we got at the rest. And we will get through that.
A question from someone not a lawyer. So three management shakeup, three people going, chair is also not seeking another term, and the head of commercial planes is going. Do we say the whole, well, you know, I was leaving anyway, it's a retirement thing, because you don't want to give anyone even a sliver of an open door to start claiming mismanagement and suing?
Possibly so.
Question.
Yeah, it's a valid question. The one I had in my head was, is this about, oh, I don't want to say the words. The idea that it was 100% his decision.
No. But yeah.
Yeah.
Because you'd argue, well, there's a crisis. You stay, that's not the point that you throw another uncertainty into the mix, right?
There was significant pressure from within and outside Boeing for changes in terms of top management. We know that, including from here in the Middle East. Many of their most important customers, Emirates, Fly Dubai and all Boeing fleet. To be fair, Gaythar Gaith, when he was in here about a month ago, had nothing but nice things to say about Boeing. Tim Clark has been a little bit more critical of Boeing, but they are major customers, obviously major customers in their home market, the United States as well. Whatever the story behind it, he is going at the end of the year. So not a great day for Dave Calhoun, but a very, very, very good day for Donald Trump. In fact, it was the best day of Donald Trump's career. And he's 77 years old, so he's been around a little bit. But his net worth hit $6.5 billion yesterday. This time last week, we were talking about Donald Trump facing bankruptcy because on Monday, he had to find almost $500 million for a bond over his New York fraud case. Today, Tom, he's sitting in the top 500 of the Bloomberg Billionaires list. A week is a long time in politics, as some wise person once said.
Indeed it is, yeah. It's been quite the 24 or 48 hours for Donald Trump. A wild day. He's in court. So he's in court. Is that it confirmed that he's going to have to be in the dock on April the 15th or the 16th or something for one of the four criminal counts against him at the moment. And yet, he's also just realised that he's broken into the most... Well, he's always been one of the wealthiest men in the world, hasn't he? But certainly had a good day financially as well. And then also the bail amount that they were talking about. He had to come up with like $500 million yesterday. They've reduced that to a mere $175 million now as well. So not a bad day, all for all.
Not a bad day. Surprisingly,
you're hired!
Surprisingly for Donald Trump, he's been fairly quiet about all of this. Those two big stories yesterday. Firstly, the reduction in the bail amount to $175 million and the meteoric rise of Digital World Acquisition Company, effectively his Truth Social media company that led to the spike in his net worth. But he did have this to say after the court case and the reduction in value of that bond.
Well, as I say, I have a lot of cash, but I would also like to be able to use some of my cash to get elected.
Donald Trump, $6.5 billion. Of course, it is a paper fortune as well. The company ceases to be DWAC today, Digital World Acquisition Company, and becomes under the ticker DJT. It's effectively Donald Trump's social media company, Truth Social. We will, of course, as will everyone else, be watching that one very, very closely overnight. Very quickly, been watching oil prices. They are creeping higher. Brent crude knocking on $87, $88 a barrel this morning. It seems to be heading towards $90 a barrel on geopolitical concerns. We've been speaking to Jean Walters, senior economist at Emirates NBD, and we asked her, what's your outlook for the year ahead for oil?
Oil prices have risen over the course of the past 2 weeks, with Brent futures trading around $87 per barrel this morning. Prices have been driven higher by both rising geopolitical tensions and revisions to the International Energy Agency's estimates of global oil demand growth for 2024. The IEA now expects demand growth to be slightly higher, which, together with an expectation of an extension of OPEC plus production cuts further into 2024, means that the oil market balance is now expected to be in a small deficit. This balance supports our own expectation for oil prices to hold in a range between $80 to $85 a barrel for 2024. However, depending on further rises in geopolitical tensions and how strong compliance with OPEC plus cuts are, there may be some upside risk to prices, particularly if demand performs better than expected.
Jean Walters of Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Yeah, just a few weeks away until that event happens. It is one of the world's top ones when it comes to the energy industry. And delighted to be joined on the line now by one of the key players within the energy industry here in the UAE. Sara Al-Sadi is the Nuclear Safety Director at the Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation and joins us now live on Microsoft Teams. Good morning, Sara.
Hi, good morning, Richard.
Thanks for being with us. We wanted to speak to you because the UAE's nuclear authorities have recently turned on the fourth and final reactor up at Baraka, the UAE's nuclear power plant, and wanted to get your thoughts on this. First of all, briefly, before we dive into some of the safety issues, just remind us very briefly what has happened.
Okay, so good morning, everyone. First of all, As you've just mentioned, it was just recently announced by NEWA Energy Company, which is the UAE's nuclear power operator, on Saturday, the 23rd of March, that the Baraka nuclear power plant was successfully synchronized to the UAE's grid. And with this being said, I'd like to highlight that this is a major step and another historic moment for the UAE in delivering a carbon-free electricity as part of the UAE's Net Zero 2050 strategy, which aims to significantly contribute to the nation's clean energy portfolio and supports to achieve its ambitious climate goals for sure.
Can you give us a sense of just what contribution Baraka is now making to the UAE's national grid? Because you just say all four reactors are now connected. The basic maths I was doing, and it's always dangerous when I start doing maths, Sarah, but the basic maths I got was that the UAE as a country, our installed capacity is about 35 megawatts, and this plant is about 5 megawatts, so about 15.15% by my very basic and dangerous maths. What can you tell us?
So if you speak about one unit out of the four would actually produce 1,400 megawatts of electricity, putting that in mind that this plant as one unit synchronized to the grid is expected to generate 12.5% of the electricity to the UAE. And this gives a total of four units contributing as of 25% to the electricity of the UAE.
Okay, so it's a significant contribution. But let's talk about some of the safety issues that this raises. Obviously, anywhere around the world, there are those who do have concerns about the safety of nuclear power plants. In general, what can you say to those people this morning here in the UAE who hear that the fourth reactor has been turned on and their first thought is not great, more zero carbon energy? They think, I'm a bit concerned about nuclear power.
Absolutely. And that's where we are here as of the Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation. We are the regulator to the nuclear safety and security in the UAE. And this brings the importance of FANR as a regulator. And this comes as an importance from different perspectives. First, having said with that achievement in there, first, this ensures or gives a successful compliance with the FANR's regulatory framework and its regulations, which is essential to maintain the obtained operational license that was given by FANR. Also, the proper synchronization provides also an assurance that the plant operates safely and does not impose or pose any risk to the grid or the surrounding environment. So generally speaking, this process gives a level of assurance to FANR that the nuclear energy remains safe, reliable, and effective component to the energy mix. And this is definitely bringing us in line with FANR's mission that aims at protecting the public and the environment from the harmful effects of the ionizing radiation and to ensure that the exclusively peaceful use of the nuclear energy in an integrated manner.
I was looking at the changing nature of these risks in the 70 or so year history of nuclear power. And we know about the traditional ones that have caused problems in the past. Human error is one of them. Earthquake in Japan has been one of them. Military attack has not yet. But obviously that is potentially a threat. But I was reading comments from one of your colleagues, Christopher Victorson, the Director General of the FANR, saying the new thing is the rapidly changing environment, putting more pressure on all of us. And he said that throws up more risks. How does climate change pose a risk, and what are you doing to mitigate against that?
Yes, so it's being really looked at differently right now when you look at not only the production of the energy itself to the society and the public, but the long-term possible impacts of the climate change that could impact in a different way or a negative manner to the environment from a cooling perspective as well, different kind of impacts that could happen on the long run. Also, the different environmental changes that could impact on the aging of the plant as well. So all of these actually being now looked at differently among different different regulators, and we are looking even into amending our regulatory framework to take into consideration the possible climate change or impact on the long run of the plant. And we, as a regulator, we look into safety. And when I speak about safety, it's nuclear safety, the safety of the equipment, the safety of the plant from human error, as you have mentioned, from security perspective, as well as from emergency perspective. So we conduct the different exercises on a different timelines in coordination with the national organizations. We've got also some radiation monitors around the plant and around the country as well. So there are different regulatory requirements and approaches that we perform all together just to ensure the robustness of our oversight from nuclear regulatory perspective.
A quick final word on spent nuclear fuel, or nuclear waste as it's sometimes called. I know that in the short term you're storing that at Baraka. You've got pools to cool it, you've got dry casks, but this is a process that takes hundreds, thousands, even more years for this spent nuclear fuel to fully decontaminate. What are you doing in terms of the safety of the spent nuclear fuel?
Okay, so this is also under FANR's mandate, of which we just need to ensure that there is a proper management when it comes to the spent fuel of the Baraka MPP. But just to put in mind that within the design, or I would say the innovative and the modern design of the Baraka power plant, where it considers the latest technologies, it can withstand the spent fuel for up to more than almost 20 years. But in line or parallel to this, we are putting together all the needed regulations in place and also the plans to look forward together with NEWA to see what is next after the 20 years from operation, and how would be it be taken care of in terms of waste management afterwards, after the 20 years, whether it's a dry storage for a temporary use and then looking further for the geological deep repository and so on. So we are still into the different phases, working in parallel with the operator when it comes to this.
Fascinating work. Sara Al-Sadi, really appreciate you joining us this morning. The Nuclear Safety Director at the Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation, on the news that the fourth and final reactor up at Baraka has been connected to the UAE national grid.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, we are. We are living in a world where the global education landscape is evolving rapidly. With that comes the demands for further education and, of course, an ever-evolving global marketplace and, more pertinently, workforce as well. The Higher Colleges of Technology, HCT, is synonymous with the UAE. They are the UAE's largest federal higher education institute, and they are taking a leading role through its applied educational model transformation, aptly named Shaping the Future, to adopt apprenticeship based programs to enhance educational offerings. Let's get more on this one, if we can, from the Chief Academic Officer of HCT. An absolute pleasure to be joined live in studio by Dr. Luc Verbeur, who joins us this morning. Dr. Luc, thank you so much indeed for being with us.
My pleasure.
Good to have you on board, and thanks for your time with us here today. Why the need now for the apprenticeship model? Has it been something that's been lacking?
Yeah, I think it has. If you look internationally, you see that a lot of countries have adopted that particular model, and they have done that for quite a few years. And the result of that is that the employment figures of their graduates are pretty high. And so it was felt about a year, 2 years ago here in the UAE that we also had to move to that particular model to ensure that the graduates would be very successful in finding a job and keeping a job after graduation.
How do you approach it when designing a program like this? And I mentioned there in the intro the ever-evolving landscape when it comes to the workforce at the moment, specifically when it comes to the Emirati workforce of the future. How do you design? Are there certain sectors, certain industries that you're pushing towards?
Well, There's a few things that we do to be more successful. One is we look clearly at the programs that we offer. And when we offer the programs, we look at how much employability is there to be expected. So industry segments where there's a lot of need for labor, those are the ones that we increase our programs. So that's one thing that we do to illustrate. The healthcare system is going to grow even more and more in the UAE. And because of that, we've introduced new programs related to nursing, midwifery and so forth. So this is one way in which we try to be more and more aligned with the industry demands. But once we've done that, then it's all about how to design the apprenticeship as part of those programs. And we've taken quite a few steps for that. And that is a total redesign of the programs. Look at when exactly do we want our students to do the apprenticeship as part of the four-year program.
There are so many phrases we could use here: applied learning, hands-on experience, real-world skills. Is there more demand for employers now? Does it make a prospective candidate more attractive to an employer moving forward, not just here in the UAE, but worldwide?
Yeah, very much, very much. What you see happening is that in particular countries, traditional research universities even try to move themselves into the applied domain because they've realized that to have brains and be educated from a theoretical point of view is great. But if you don't know how to apply it, how to utilize it, you don't have the impact that you need to have. So I think it's a global trend where you can see that even traditional research universities move into the space of being more applied, both in research and education, but particularly universities of applied science or polytechnics, as they're also called in particular parts of the world. They are extremely well positioned to do that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a phrase that I'm always a little bit reluctant to use, but that employability phrase as well is something that the world of academia is obviously embracing at the moment. It no longer is just the piece of paper that you get when you qualify and graduate.
Yeah, no, true. I think it's not only from a labour market perspective where there's shortage in well-educated people across the world, where you can see the pressure from the labour market onto the academic institutions, but also the governments themselves. They invest a lot of money in higher education, and they want to make sure that there is some sort of return on investment. And that means that the word that you mentioned, employability, is becoming more and more important.
It's therefore no surprise that HCT are taking the lead here, shaping the future. Quite ironic, because HCT have been part of the past, the present and the future here, haven't they not?
They have been. But I think in order to be part of the future, you have to reinvent yourself every now and then. And I think moving towards a more fundamental applied university model is going to be part of that journey, and is going to make sure that we are also going to add value in the next 10 to 15 years to come.
We've got about 30 seconds remaining. I just want to tap into your greater international experience of academia as well. From what you've learned here during your time in the UAE and your time at HCT as well, are we set fair through these new programmes to add to the Emirati workforce moving forward?
We are, and it's amazing how fast we do that at this particular time here in the UAE and at HCT. And I've been recruiting a lot of international deans from all over the world, and I think that combined expertise and competency will really help us in the next couple of years.
Dr. Luke Verburg, thank you so much indeed for your time. Dr. Luke is the Chief Academic Officer at the Higher Colleges of Technology, obviously known as HCT.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
And we're talking about the business of Ramadan Hospitality on the Business Breakfast this morning. We've been speaking to one of the big bosses at Jumeirah Hospitality, who says that he and his team have been waiting 7 years for it to get cool enough to head out of the ballroom and take iftar and sahur outside, which got us wondering, what does Ramadan being in a cooler time of year mean for the demand for tents? So we are joined by one maker of fine temporary structures. Minnie Wellington is Commercial Director at the Arena Group. Minnie, it's nice to see you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, a cooler Ramadan, what does that mean for the demand for tents?
Well, certainly a lower demand for structures, as everyone wants to enjoy the cooler weather. So we've had not many inquiries come in for structures this year. A couple more sort of open-sided to allow that sort of fresh outdoor experience happen. But what we found more is the hotels and venues are looking at utilising their outdoor space. And therefore, it's just a touch of Ramadan decor, some key furniture items, just to create that sort of ambiance rather than being inside and locked away. They're all enjoying the outdoor space.
Okay, so let's break that down a little bit. Could you put a really rough percentage figure for me on what the drop in demand for tents has been?
Wow. I would probably put it quite high at about sort of 70%. Of all the inquiries we've had this year, I could probably count on my hand how many required structures.
But I can also see, as you say, you're changing to meet the demand. I was on your website. You have created a Ramadan super deck.
Yes, we have. So this is utilising a product that is unique to Arena. It's a modular system, and we've used it by creating various platforms outside to then give sort of elevated areas, majlis areas, VIP areas for Ramadan, and then utilising our in-house production facilities and furniture rental to then add that sort of elevated Ramadan feel.
Because you're a business and you obviously have been taking stock of what demand was going to be like. How many more years are you forecasting than that outdoor rather than indoor tent, non-tent demand will stay there for?
Good question. Probably another 5 years. But there's also the need as we get into sort of February time, we've seen the rain come down. So there's also, it's lovely being able to be outside and enjoy the fantastic weather that we have here in the UAE, but also to maybe offer a structure, be it open-sided, for that sort of weather that can hit us unexpectedly.
What are we seeing in general with some of the newer hotels that are coming on? Are people still looking at this year by year, we need a new Ramadan structure, or are hotels and other venues starting to sort of build their own semi-permanent spaces in?
It's a combination. We find that a lot of hotels are utilising their own space, as I said earlier, either inside a ballroom or outside, using their own indoor furniture, their own facilities. I think there's less money spent from previous years. I remember when I came here 18 years ago, Ramadan was this massive sort of spectacle in terms of who had the best tent along the beach or wherever. And there was a lot of sponsorship behind it. I think now that's sort of gone the wayside a little bit, and the hotels and venues are doing it more in-house rather than outsourcing it and getting sponsors.
What about sustainability? Is there more of a focus on reusable structures, stuff that can be carried over year to year?
Absolutely. So sustainability is a key practice that we follow in Arena, and it's something that's at the forefront of our thinking. And sustainability, in terms of if you could get a multi-year contract with a venue hotel, then you can work with them. We do it with a hotel in Abu Dhabi. It's now our fourth year that we've worked with them. And we created a skeletal design, which each year we use that and then just enhance it, either different paint color or a slightly different finish. But we're reusing the same components year on year, just tweaking it up to fit their design.
What does that do for their costs?
Well, obviously that helps them a lot because they are repurposing it. So therefore their costs annually are a lot lower than if they were building it new each year.
How far does that sustainability interest go? I'm saying hotels, but venues, restaurants and the rest, do they care to the level of they care where, I don't know, the wood in a structure is coming from, if something's being replanted, if it's sustainable? How deep is it?
I mean, I can't speak for all hotels and venues because each person and venue would have their own remit. But we do find there are certain clients that we work with that are very particular about the finishes and the products that we use. So we work with them to ensure that we deliver that.
How much of an impact is Instagram having on what people want from their Ramadan setup?
Social media in general. So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, it's a huge market platform for us. And we promote all our projects on our socials. And we find that a lot of people have come to us and said, oh, I saw that. Oh, do you still have that available? Could we, you know, so it is, it's a big impact. It's a very strong platform for us.
What in terms, though, of what you're designing? I mean, it's iftar, but do people still want stuff that's going to look good on their social that has, I don't know, selfie areas?
Absolutely. Instagrammable moments are a big key thing. So we have an activation department that deal with mainly exhibition stands, but they have done a number of Instagrammable moments throughout Dubai for their clients for just that very reason. So yes, it's we have an in-house design team that work with our clients to create those.
Iftar, but make it look good on social.
Make it look good on social, absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Minnie Wallington is Commercial Director at Arena Group, talking to us about whether or not Ramadan moving into a cooler time of year means less demand for tents. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.